Bristol, For the Record, a new local oral history podcast from BCFM Radio in partnership with MShed Bristol and funded by the National Lottery Heritage Fund.
Behind every strong city, there is an even stronger army of women creating the bricks with which to build it. This is a quote from Jane Duffus, the author of The Women Who Built Bristol, volumes 1, 2 and 3, which is a bursting collection of hundreds of brilliant women who helped to shape the Bristol into the vibrant city it is today. And now I am very lucky to be in the company of Jane for this episode of Bristol for the Record. Hello, Jane.
Hello, very nice to meet you.
So this book, three volumes.
Well, I should add, it's almost three volumes. Volume three is being written, so it's not quite out yet. It'll be out in a couple of years, but it's still in the creation process at the moment. But volumes one and two are definitely out and available.
The third volume is underway, so yeah. You're obviously loving to write these books. What inspired you to write them?
Frustration. I get frustrated about a lot of things. So I moved to Bristol. I'm originally from the Southwest, and I went away to uni. I went to Nottingham. I went to other places. I ended up in London, like a lot of people do when you graduate. And I lived and worked there for a long time as a journalist on lots of newsstand magazines. And then I moved down to Bristol about 15 years ago now. And I'm a nosy person. So I used to work on, you know, kind of like gossipy, kind of lifestyle features-y kind of magazines. I like knowing people's stories. And when I moved to Bristol, I wanted to know more about the city that I was now living in. And so I did those kind of obvious things. I went to the various museums and I read some of the existing history books that existed. And I wasn't at this point looking for stories about women. I was just looking for stories about Bristol. But without even thinking about it, what became really, really obvious was that we were just being told the men's history of Bristol. And I found that quite frustrating. I mean, obviously, that's a sweeping exaggeration. Obviously, people like Lucienne Boyce has written a great book on the suffragettes in Bristol. Madge Dresser has done lots of great work. Helen Reed, you know, there's a couple of other people. But they are, unfortunately, really overshadowed by the men who've written books about Bristol. And this is not just true of Bristol. This is true of any city anywhere or any town. Local history tends to be written by older men. That is changing, I should add. That is changing in more recent years. But traditionally, going back, that tended to be the case. And I guess people tend to write and research about people like themselves. And so you could say that I've done exactly that as well. I've written and researched about people like me, i.e. women. And so, yeah, so the first book, Volume 1, was published in 2018, and it was published to coincide with the centenary of when some women got the vote. I always stress some, because it was certainly not a whole vote for everybody. It meant that all men over 21 got the vote, and some women who met quite a lot of criteria, such as having a university degree, owning property, being married and so forth, got the vote. What that actually meant was that a lot of the suffragists and the suffragettes, I'm always very keen to stress the difference between those two, who had campaigned, didn't actually achieve the vote in 1918 when the partial vote was won. But what it also means is that in 2028, it is the real centenary. And so all those celebrations that we had 10 years ago, or almost 10 years ago, we get to do all over again and even better. But anyway, I've diverged slightly. So the first volume came out in 2018 as part of a year-long programme of events in Bristol to mark suffrage centenary. And because outside of London, Bristol had the highest volume of suffrage activity. And that was obviously a very exciting thing. I never intended to write more than one book, but it was
just escalated.
It really kind of took on a life of its own. I was very, very pleasantly surprised with how the book took off, with how people grabbed it and ran with it. People were buying multiple copies and giving them, like, you know, if they were a teacher or a parent at a school, they were buying copies to give to school libraries, because as I'm sure you know, schools and libraries are very underfunded and unfortunately often have to rely on people making donations. And people were then coming up with their own projects. School teachers, in some cases, were using the book as inspiration for different projects in history classes in their schools. Art groups were using it for community art projects. You know, so many different different stuff was going on. I went to an event at, I don't know if event's the right word, but it was an event at the prison in Bristol about a year ago, where they had been involved in a project with Lucien Boyce, who I mentioned earlier, who did a lot of work on the suffragette movement in Bristol. And they had created a mural and they'd done a sort of history project on that. And along with lots of other people, I was invited to an event inside the museum where I spoke to some of the prisoners who'd been involved with this artwork and who'd been involved in researching it. And it was really gratifying and rewarding. It never would have occurred to me, because also Bristol Prison is a men's prison now. It didn't used to be. It actually was a site, and this was why the project came about. It actually was a women's prison previously. And during the suffrage movement, there were a number of women who were held there, who were forcibly fed after they'd undergone hunger strikes. So some pretty grisly stuff happened to women in that prison previously. And that was why the mural and the project came about.
Can I just ask, you said...
Sorry, like, I could go on.
No, it's fine. It's fine. You said the suffrage movement in Bristol was the biggest outside of London.
Yes.
And then you made a distinction between two groups of that movement. Can you just explain that?
Yes, absolutely. So there's the suffragists and the suffragettes. And I'm very keen that people... I'm glad you asked, because I'm always very, very keen to make that distinction. Because a lot of people, understandably, if it's not something that you spent a lot of time thinking about, you just know about the suffragettes, or you lump everyone under the term of suffragettes. The suffragettes came around in 1907, so quite late into the movement. They were the group led by Emmeline Pankhurst, who's a name most people are familiar with, and her daughters, Christabel, Sylvia. And they were the people who led lots of quite militant actions, such as window smashing campaigns, some arson attacks against property. They were the people who, in frustration, instigated going under hunger strike in prison and then endured forcible feeding. You know, they were troublemakers in a good way.
And a lot of this happened in Bristol as well.
A lot of this happened in Bristol. It happened obviously all around the country, but there was a great deal happened in Bristol. But... so they started, they kind of formed in 1907. But if you think that the roots of the suffrage movement, as we know it now, can be dated back to 1866. So that's obviously a long time before 1907. And these are the women who we call the suffragists. They are peaceful campaigners. So they were the people who, largely women, who would do stuff like letter writing campaigns, petitions, give talks, you know, quiet, peaceful demonstrations. But because a lot of what they did wasn't headline grabbing, it wasn't stunts. And I totally understand why the suffragettes in frustration resorted to the actions that they did. But I also think it's very unfair that the decades and decades of work done by the suffragists gets ignored. But actually, we date the suffragists back to 1866, because that was when the first massive petition went to Parliament. But there are records that go back, you know, centuries previously of lots of women and some men who, you know, were lobbying for women to get the vote. But it is also, as I mentioned briefly earlier, it wasn't until 1918 that most men got the vote, because the suffrage movement wasn't just lobbying for votes for women. It was also lobbying for votes for everyone, because working class men didn't have the vote. It was only rich, wealthy men who had votes. And obviously that's not a fair system. But it was all the suffragists and suffragettes were also lobbying for many other things, such as working rights for women. Women were not seen as the legal guardians of their own children, which was astonishing.
Wow.
Really astonishing. This wasn't very long ago. And a woman, you know, say she was a campaigner, she went to prison for something that she had done. Her husband chose not to support this. He had every legal right to take her child away and deny her access to her child, which is brutal.
Wow. Doesn't surprise me either for some reason. So you've got hundreds of women contained in this book.
500. Each book has 250 different women.
Do you have any highlights, any favourite stories of individuals?
I have lots. I mean, it's a little bit like asking a parent who's your favourite child.
Yeah.
Absolute favourite when I am pushed to, you know, held at gunpoint, and is Mary Griffiths. Now, Mary, I am a runner, and so I've tried very, very hard to find any women with either a sporting or a running connection. On the day that the Clifton Suspension Bridge was opened, she wanted to be the very first person to cross it on foot. She was 21 years old and she worked as a barmaid. So what I also love about this, and what I should make clear about the books generally, is that I'm very keen in both books, not just to tell the stories of, so say, obvious women. And by that, I mean women who wrote novels or opened schools or co-founded the Women's Police Force or, you know, painted great works of art. Obviously, those women should and are included. But I'm also very, very keen that we tell the stories of working class and what I affectionately call ordinary women, women who worked in factories, women who kept the country going when men were away at war, because it was largely men who were away at war, women who were left picking up the pieces after their husband was killed in a mining accident and suddenly she was left fending for six children and had to find a way to keep going. You know, all these stories I think are really, really important. And Mary Griffiths falls into this category. You could argue that someone going across the suspension bridge, so what? But I beg to differ. So anyway, on the day that the suspension bridge was opened, Mary wanted to be the very first person to cross it on foot. She snuck under the ribbon just before it was cut, but a man had had the same idea. And Mary ended up in a race with him from the Clifton side to the Lee Wood side. And her uncle was there and he was shouting words of encouragement. And he was going, run, Mary, run. And she was wearing, because of course it was Victorian time, she had one of these long, heavy dresses on. The man didn't, hasten to point out. So she had to hitch up her dress, hold it over her knees, and she had to pelt it across the bridge. And she beat him by a few yards. She paid her one penny toll with pleasure. And I just think that's fantastic. And there's so many other great things that Mary went on to do. They're all in the book. She's in volume two.
She sounds great, by the way.
She is. And I was really pleased to find a photograph of her towards her later years, sort of in, like, it was in the obituary really for her.
She sounds like a rebel.
She was a rebel, and she looks exactly like you want her to look, like a kind of take no nonsense woman, and I love and admire her for it. There's another woman who I really love, and every time I do a lot of talks, I did a talk the other day, and every time I do a talk, I always mention this woman because I love her. I love her so much. And it pains me that no one has heard of her. And every time I talk about this woman, I say, has anyone in this room heard of Anne Lutton? And I have given, I don't know, well over 100 talks about this book to date. And so far, not one single person has said yes, which makes me sad. However,
never heard of her.
I am on a one-woman campaign to change that. Anne Lutton was a Methodist preacher in the 17-somethings. I would have to check, actually, which is awful. I can't remember the top of my head. But I have got 500 women floating around my head, so I can't remember the details of all of them. But in the 1700s, she was a Methodist preacher. She came from Ireland, but she ended up living in Cotham, which was where she worked for the final decades of her life. She was a very quiet person. She was very studious, very inward looking. You know, she loved people. She loved sharing. She could teach in a multitude of languages, and she loved sharing the stories that she had learned from the Bible. But when she first came to Bristol, she lived with some family friends, and she found their what she called sociable way of life something difficult to get her head around. Now, I don't think this family, they were called the Westcotts, were wild party animals at all. I think they just had friends round for dinner sometimes and maybe the odd drinks party. But for Mary, this was absolutely a lot for her to get her head around. And so she came up with her six-stage process for how to cope with this. And I'm just going to quickly run you through those six bullet points and you
go for it. So how to cope with what
tricky social situations.
Okay, got you.
So you might want to just jot these down, or anyone listening might want to jot these down. It can be quite handy in the future. Number one, pray for strength before meeting the guest. Number two, find in advance passages of scripture that might be useful to the guest. Number three, look for openings in the conversation to share those passages of scripture. Number four, be mindful that the Lord is listening to every word and don't get too carried away. Number five, I think this is the best one, make your parting words impressive. And number six, share a prayer with the guest as they depart. Now, I think, A, we can all learn something for our next social occasion there. And yep. B, we can all agree that Anne was the life and soul of every single occasion that she attended. And I just think, you know, there's a lot more to Anne, obviously, than that. You know, she never married. She never had a family of her own. But she was very much welcomed and adopted and adored by her community. She was, you know, after she died, she went blind for the final few decades of her life. But she continued to preach and to teach and to sort of be a very, very active part of the community. And after she died, the Lutton Memorial Hall was opened in Cotham. which still sort of survives. It's not a church anymore. It's sort of been converted. Some of the building survives. It's sort of been converted into a block of flats that's added on the side. But you can sort of see a bit of it. But yeah, you know, there's just so many amazing women to choose from. You know, it's really hard. I'm just kind of flicking through a copy of the book now because it's so hard to choose. It's like when you flick through the TV channels. It's like there's too much choice. I don't know what to watch anymore.
How about any women of colour in Bristol over the years?
That's an interesting question. And it's really hard to find many examples. And that is something I've spent quite a lot of time researching, talking to other people who know better than I do, trying to get more information. There are a handful. There's not nearly as many as they should be. The ones who are there generally fall into two camps. Either they are former enslaved people, but there aren't very many of them, largely because at Bristol, unfortunately, and is well known, has a difficult history with slavery, something we're all very much trying to work out how to address, and it's not an easy one. But the slave owners in Bristol largely owned plantations elsewhere, and that's where the enslaved people were based. They didn't generally bring them into the UK. If they did, the ship records tended to record their name as either their surname was Black or their surname was that of their, in brackets, owner.
Yeah.
So that makes it very difficult to find out who these people actually were and research them and get their actual stories. The other camp that people fall into is much more recently. So people who came over, for instance, on the Windrush generation and who were involved with things like setting up St. Paul's Carnival and were involved in the St. Paul's community and involved with activities there. Obviously, those people, you know, many of them are still with us, which is lovely. And one thing which I didn't mention about the books is I only write about women who are no longer alive. Those women, I hope, won't be included in Volume 3 in the nicest possible way, because I hope they stay with us for a long time to come. But there are a couple who have passed away, and so we write about those. But it is very much something I'm aware of, and I would welcome all suggestions that anyone listening might have. I'm always open to suggestions, and I'm very conscious that this is something that needs improving.
Is the book full of just individuals, or are there any groups of women?
But there's a section at the back of Volume 1 called Women's Work. And so that sort of addresses what you're asking about. And so it has a section here called the Bristol Female Mission Society, which was an organisation run by lots of do-gooding women in the Victorian era who sort of took in, you know, young girls who were down on their luck. Maybe their parents had died. Maybe they had no money. Maybe they were strays in the weirdest possible way. And they sort of took them in and they trained them up to become servants or to have a trade of some kind.
When did this happen? Are there any particular buildings where that happened in the city?
Well, I guess one obvious example would be the Red Lodge Museum behind sort of where the Bristol Beacon is, which still exists. And honestly, if people haven't yet been to visit the museum, I do recommend it. It's an amazing building. And that was sort of part of this system. It was run by a woman called Mary Carpenter, who is a well-known name in Bristol's history. And she was very involved in philanthropy and good deeds. It was run as a reformatory for the sort of girls who I've just mentioned. There are, you know, as is inevitable, sadly, a lot of stories that perhaps these girls weren't always treated as kindly as they could have been. But there are also stories that these girls, you know, their lives did improve as a result of having been there. And then other sections in the book include things such as the various factories. You know, Bristol is well known for chocolate factories, for cotton factories, tobacco, obviously. Pin factories is something that people don't tend to think about, making pins.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
And what's a pin?
Imagine if you're sewing and you use a little pin to hold the fabric together. Sweet factories, you know, there were loads of them. Corset factories. Corsets were big business around here.
So with the factories around Bristol over the decades, were they mostly employing women?
Yeah, mostly they were employed. Women were cheap labour. Women didn't get paid as much. Well, women still don't get paid as much as men, but then they got paid significantly less than men. So women were largely employed on sort of like production line jobs. And things like pins were made at home. So you would go in and you'd get the raw materials, and then you could take them home. So if you've got your little kids at home, they're, you know, running around playing at home, and you can be at home looking after your kids, and you can, it's called pin money. You've heard the phrase?
No.
You know, it's a sort of, it probably is dying out now, but people used to say, you know, you do a little job and they go, oh, it's just pin money. And that's where that comes from. People would take a little job home.
Like a side hustle.
Yeah, like a side hustle. Exactly. Yeah. It's an old fashioned side hustle. And yeah, and so things like that. And like boots as well. Boots were often made at home because they were all hand stitched. And so women would get the stuff from the factory, take it home, stitch the boots, and then take them back again, and then get paid once a week.
Yeah, this is really interesting. So the roles of women in society at large, but then also in Bristol specifically, how has that changed? So we're talking about factory workers now. What have been the other roles that women have been key in Bristol?
I'd say the voluntary sector. Now, if you look, a lot of the voluntary sector, if you look at the people running these organisations, it's often women, you know, like the Bristol Drugs Project, you know, Bristol Women's Voice, obviously. There's so many organisations that have a woman at the helm. Obviously, plenty have men in key roles too. But I wonder if there's a reason why women are drawn to these roles. You know, is it that kind of caring, nurturing side, which I kind of hope it's not, to be honest, because that feels a bit stereotypical. But, you know, what is it that draws women to these kinds of roles? Or is it just a coincidence? I don't know.
From your research, have you discovered any business women over the years that have been successful in Bristol?
Gosh, lots. Well, the woman who invented Specsavers, whose name I can't remember because she's still alive and therefore isn't in the books, but she's from Bristol. And there's another woman called, oh my goodness, I can't remember her name. She's either Vera or Victoria someone, which is awful. I'm so sorry. But she invented a business called International Mailing, which doesn't sound very exciting. She had an office on Park Street, and there's an amazing photo, if you go, I think it's in the Bristol archives, of some women on the roof, the flat roof of this building on Park Street, just sort of in their lunch break, sort of playing like netball or something, or like a ball game on the roof, which I just think is great. But she invented this business that just kind of made bulk mailing easier for people, obviously days long, long before internet and email and all that kind of stuff. And the reason I mention that is a couple of weeks ago, someone tagged me in a post on Instagram, and I had no idea who they were, but they were distant relatives of this woman. And this business still exists somewhere.
Wow.
And they had come across her entry in the book, and therefore were sort of, it was a centenary or an anniversary of this business. And though, so they'd read the book and were tagging me in it, which was very kind of them. And I had no idea this business still existed. I mean, it's changed a name and obviously changed ownership as the woman's no longer with us. But I just thought, wow, that's amazing.
From your research, what have been some of the key moments and movements in history relating to women in Bristol? So we've talked about the suffrage movement. Are there any other key moments in time you can think of?
Like with the unions, so like the working unions, there have been a lot of strikes over the years. You know, the Black Friday wasn't initially, you know, a big commercial sale, retail sale day where everyone got a telly for half price. It used to be.
stampeding into shops.
Yeah, it didn't used to be that. Black Friday was originally the name of a massive kind of workers' union protest where everyone was, you know, from dockers to factory workers, men, women, everyone who was working had enough of, you know, terrible conditions, terrible pay, bosses who treated them appallingly, all that kind of stuff. It all had got to a head, and there was a massive protest in Bristol involving marches. There were casualties, the police behaved appallingly, all this stuff kicked off. Families had been striking for a long time, they had been starving, you know, as is the way
so
during strikes.
When was this happening, this Black Friday movement?
Don't ask me this. It was during the Victorian era. Okay. Sometimes I'm useless at remembering dates off the top of my head. I'm so sorry, I'm not a numbers person. But the point is that while that was very much a case that the women came out to support the men and the women workers, but lots of the women who were the sort of women who would run like the missions and the reformatories that I mentioned a few minutes ago, these women, you know, very much saw themselves as socialists, and they saw themselves as wanting to help the people, to make things better for people who didn't have as comfy a life as them. Because what's always been the case, because, for instance, if you look at the suffrage movement, people often complain that, A, it's a very white movement, and B, it's a very middle and upper class movement. But there's reasons for that. The reason it's a very white movement is that, as we've just talked about a few minutes ago, you know, we're talking about 100 plus years ago. And largely, you know, if there was a person of colour in your house, unfortunately, we're probably a servant. And, you know, they didn't have the time, the energy to start lobbying and campaigning.
They didn't have the agency to do
so. No, they were too busy trying to keep a job. Because also the other factor that it's largely a middle class and upper class movement is for exactly the same reason. If you're a working class woman, you cannot, well, A, you haven't got time because you're busy looking after your family, you're looking after your job, you're trying to keep your head above water. But if you get so much as a sniff of trouble, or someone gets so much as a sniff of trouble about you, you go to prison, you get called up, your name's in the paper, you know, your employer might not support that and they might kick you out of your job, done and dusted, and you can't afford it.
And I feel like that still happens today, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But that's why it's a white, middle and upper class movement. You know, it's notable that the only woman of colour who is called up, sort of, again, when this question is asked, is Princess Sophia Duleep, who, you know, as her name suggests, she was a princess. She was Queen Victoria's goddaughter. She lived in Kensington Palace. She didn't have to go out for a job. She could afford to stand on street corners and sell copies of suffragette newspapers. And she disgraced the royal family by doing this. But she didn't care and she carried on doing it anyway. But she was in a very unique position to be able to do that.
It's funny how Black Friday back then is so different to what it is now. It couldn't be more opposite, could it?
It's extraordinary. Every year when it comes round Black Friday, I always kind of go on Twitter and start sharing like links to the real Black Friday as opposed to just retail Black Friday.
So for your new volume, volume 3 of The Women That Built Bristol, can you give us any sort of sneaky previews that you're researching on?
There is a woman called Ada Ball who was a survivor from the Titanic, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, way cool.
Yeah, so she's going in the book. There's loads
So from Bristol?
She's from Bristol.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she, I can't remember the details off my head because I will be perfectly honest, I haven't worked on this book for a while. I've been sidetracked by other projects. But so yeah, she's going in the book. And she lived for quite a while afterwards. She had, you know, she had stories to tell people. Not that many people survived the Titanic. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
God, there's all sorts in there. What I love about the books as they develop is volume one very much has what I would call, in brackets, obvious women. So the Mary Carpenters, the Annie Kennys, the Hannah Moores, the Elizabeth Blackwells that you've heard of. The people who, if you've read a list of...
I've heard of Hannah Moore. Isn't there a primary school in Bristol?
There is a
Bristol.
Primary school called Hannah Moore School.
Hannah Moore again? Just
Hannah Moore was a writer and a blue stocking and a philanthropist. So she was very much in the literary circle and she was very acclaimed for her writing. And so she knew a lot of people and she supported some younger writers or some working class writers as well. So she was a good deed doer with her works, as a lot of these women were. And so, yeah, people like that who, you know, if you read, you know, the Bristol Post every so often will do around International Women's Day, they'll do a top 100 women from Bristol list. And these women all pop up, you know. And so, you know, there they are. But I've got 250 women in each book, so we need a lot more than a top 100 list can suffice. And so volume two, I thought, was really interesting because you start to get a lot more really unusual people and you start to get recommendations from people. And I also decided to allow a few murderers and ne'er-do-wells into the book, which there's only about 12, 15, so there's not too many. But I didn't want to give the false impression that women only do good deeds, because obviously not all women are saints. Some women do bad stuff. That's just what happens. It's life.
Yeah, and I think that's really important to say sometimes, isn't it? Because I think we often think of different groups as a monolith. Mm. But, you know, groups of women or groups of people of colour or groups of disabled people, we're all different, aren't we?
Yeah, not everyone's perfect. So not all women are saints and heroes. So most of them are, obviously. But a couple aren't. There's a couple of bad apples. But there's all sorts in here. You know, look at this. I'm just flicking through this book. Landlord of the Jolly Sailor. We don't even know this woman's name, but I've included her because she was accidentally killed during a fight in her pub. She died in 1751, shot by sailors who were trying to press gang men into joining, which press ganging is when you kind of force people to join your ship, to work on your ship against their will. And they don't really want to, but you kind of hold them at gunpoint and make them do it. And that's called press ganging.
Where was the Jolly Sailor pub? Where's that?
The Jolly Sailor was on Marsh Street in the city centre.
Ah, Marsh Street. I know that's behind the Sainsbury's, isn't it?
Oh,
Yeah, I know Marsh Street. Yeah,
there you go. Well, it's not, the pub's not there anymore, but you can. I think that's also the other thing about these books is there's so many stories about street, and you know the buildings aren't there anymore, or the street might still be there and the building's there, but it's now used for a different purpose, or it's flats or whatever. But you walk around the city and you see the whole place in a different light.
So, thinking about the present and now, are there any women in Bristol at the moment that are really inspiring you by what they're doing in the city?
Oh, yes, but I'm not going to answer that. I'm not going to name anybody because...
Oh, please.
No. I'm not going to name anybody because it's such a difficult question, because I'm in the very fortunate position that I know lots of amazing women in Bristol. And if I just said to you now the first name that comes to mind, I would then leave this room and feel terrible that I hadn't then mentioned this person, this person, this person, this person. And I'd feel awful about it. So I'm not going to name anyone. I'm really sorry.
That is absolutely fine. Fair enough. So how do you see the role in general of women in Bristol today then? Let's keep it general.
The role of women in Bristol? Well, I don't think people should give us a role. I think we're people. We don't need a role as such. I think... key things, and this isn't just for Bristol, is we need to be paid equally. A lot of people seem, and including women, seem under the impression that the gender pay gap is long done and dusted, which is wildly inaccurate. So we need to get that sorted. We need to get childcare sorted. You know, back in the 1970s, in the proper second wave of feminism, when all the consciousness was raising was happening, when there were all these conferences and movements and demands being made by really agitated women everywhere, you know, a lot of those key demands still haven't been met. You know, we still don't have free childcare on demand. We still don't have equal pay. We still don't have easy access to abortion. You might think that, you know, abortion, fine, in the UK, you can have an abortion, but there are many hoops that you have to jump through to get that, and that's not acceptable. You know, there's so many things that we have been lobbying for decades and we still don't have, so there is a long, long way to go. But I don't necessarily, I would dispute your word role that you used earlier, because
I don't think it's
women's role to do anything in particular, just as I don't think it's men's role to do anything in particular. But I think there is a long way to go. And I don't necessarily think that the burden for whatever it is that you're trying to solve should fall on the shoulders exclusively of one type of person. I think there's a lot that people can do to support each other, even if they're not from that particular group. But yeah, there's definitely a long way to go for women.
Why has the history of women in general and in Bristol been overlooked and squashed?
Well, it's because I think, and I've mentioned this casually to various other people who also write history books or are interested in history, typically, local history or history generally is seen as a hobby for retired white men of a certain type. I'm immediately thinking of Ken Barlow from Coronation Street, who after he retired, and I can use him because he's a fictional character, who after he retired from being a school teacher, he started writing local history books about Weatherfield. And that's lovely. And he represents many, many, many men, white men, white retired middle-class men just like him, who pursue the same hobby upon retirement. And that's fine. But people only tend to write about people like them or people that they already know about. And so therefore, Ken Barlow is only large. I'm poor. I'm using Ken because he's not real. Ken Barlow is only going to write about other Ken Barlows. He's only going to write about other white old men. And so, like I said at the beginning, I'm as guilty of that as well. I'm only writing about other women, you know, and I go to great lengths not to write about men because I don't need to. So, yeah.
So to finish off the interview, I'm really interested. How do you see the future for you?
My goodness.
And how do you see the future for women in Bristol? Or what would you like to see?
Well, I think what I would like to see is probably easier to answer than how I actually see. I would like to see, for women in Bristol, I would like to see more women in senior and chairing positions at businesses, not just charities, but all kinds of businesses. I think that would make a massive difference. I would like to see more women in senior positions at the council. I would like a woman mayor, please. Well, we're not having a mayor anymore, but I would like a woman council leader. I know we have had one in the past.
Yeah, Barbara Jank, wasn't it? Yep. Before the mayor system came in.
And yep. Helen Holland, was she council leader? She was certainly something high up if she wasn't leader. And actually, Bristol doesn't do too badly. We do have, you know, mostly female MPs. So we don't do too badly on that score at the moment. But I would like to see that continue and or improve. I would like, you know, Bristol has a really bad working poverty situation. You know, so many mums and families who work, who have jobs, multiple jobs, are still having to rely on food banks, which is just disgusting. Really, really appalling. And that makes me very angry. You know, there's so many things that needs to improve. But I would like to see those things changing. Like, I go running, and not every day, but like when it's summer, you're wearing a vest top, you're wearing clothing appropriate to the thing that you're doing. And, you know, men seem to think it's okay to shout stuff out of their car windows because they're in their car. So they've got their metal armor around them and they're driving off. They're cowards. But it's like, it's not acceptable. None of this is acceptable. None of the way that women is treated. And especially, you know, I'm in my 40s. It's much worse for younger women. You know, it's not on. Needs to change.
And Jane, what does the future hold for you?
My next book, which will be my sixth book, is a book about an indie record label in Bristol called Sarah Records, which I spent the last couple of years researching and putting together. And that's a quite a feminist project as well. So that's largely what my future holds. And that's largely what I'm very focused on. But in between, I still do lots of talks about the women who built Bristol books, which I love. And I'm gathering stories. I've got about 200 women for volume 3. And so I'm always kind of hearing about different women and all the rest of it. I also do, I edit a couple of magazines, so I'm busy. I do.
You sound very busy.
And I do lots of different talks about, largely about the women who built Bristol. I love going to talk to different groups and schools and community groups and, you know, WIs, you name it, about all these amazing women, and to talk to people like you as well and to share these stories. Because if the one thing that people can take away from having listened to this podcast is that they now know who Anne Lutton is, then my work here is done and I can sit easy.
Jane Duffus, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.